Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the next round, episode 460 on Max Boxing on the Leave It in the Ring radio network of David Duenez. This is your host, Steve K9 Kim, and joining me, as always, from up north in San Francisco, Golden Gate, Gabe Montoya. Gabe, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, man. How are you doing today?
I am doing well, after all the gluttony of Thanksgiving and all the debauchery of Black Friday. Folks, if you want to call in, 347-215-7598. We'll take your calls in about 15 to 20 minutes. Once again, 347-215-7598. If you want to tweet us a question or a comment, you can do so at SteveMaxBoxing, at Gable_Montoya. Or at Max Boxing Live. Folks, I have a bit of a head cold, so bear with me. But let's get started with round number one. From the Colisée de Québec in Quebec City, it was a doubleheader of power shown by Adonis Stevenson and Sergey Kovalev, who retained their titles. Adonis Stevenson in the main event takes care of the normally durable Tony Bello in six rounds. And for the WBO light heavyweight title, Sergey Kovalev, the crusher indeed, the myth lives on, stopping Ismail Salak in two rounds. Gabe, Adonis Stevenson and Tony Bellew, I thought this fight would go some rounds. I thought he'd end it between 8 and 10. Taking away even the jolting power of Superman Stevenson, I'll say this. I thought it was a pretty technical performance. I thought it was very sound, the way he darted in and out against the guy, obviously trying to counterpunch him. And I thought overall, even if you don't take into account the lethal left hand, I thought it was a very, very sound outing for Adonis Stevenson.
The thing I like about Adonis Stevenson is that every time out, he kind of shows you a different side of himself. And you know, I thought Bellew fought completely out of character, but the character that he chose was a good one. He decided to try to catch him coming in, having Stevenson be the aggressor with kind of wide hooks. Sometimes he'll lead with that right hook, and you can catch him. And he seemed to a couple times. You know, I think Bellew wanted to do that early on and then get aggressive in the second half. But really that third round, I think, when they got close and Stevenson found the range and just started unloading lefts on him, everything kind of changed a little bit. And then it just became – Bellew's thing was that he wanted it to be a second-half fight, but he didn't take anything from Stevenson in order to make it – you know, a second-half fight. By the time he ramped it up, Stevenson wasn't tired. He was just kind of dialed in, and it was just a good night. I think it really showed that he's got dimension. He can be outboxed, I think, Stevenson, but that his power is real, and his discipline gets better every time.
He found ways to get a left hand in there when it wasn't always easy. I'll say this about Bellew. He fought out of character. I mean, you don't get the nickname the Bomber without being aggressive and by being a counterpuncher. So he was out of character. But you're right. If he would have ran right into Stevenson, he would have cooperated, as Teddy Atlas would always say. I thought Bellew was game, but you know what? I thought he was outgunned, and I thought he was out-athleted. I thought the foot speed, I thought the overall quickness and the reflexes, and I thought it was a very good stoppage by the referee. Tony Bellew was out on his feet, and that could have got very, very dangerous. And I'll say this about Adonis Stevenson. Last week, I called him a young 34, and I was wrong because he's actually 36. But I'll stick by my original premise, Gabe. I think at 36, he's still relatively young. I mean, he began his career at age 29, so there's not the usual wear and tear. I think there's a lot of mileage left on the odometer as it relates to Stevenson.
Oh, I agree completely. What a nasty finisher he is. I mean, it was like two lefts. One of them was like kind of to the throat area. He's not going to be – he has to be pulled off in order to be stopped. I kind of like that about him, but it makes him kind of scary. There's kind of a – something else going on with him when he's in the ring. He really seems to enjoy his work. But you know, I thought overall, you know, Bellew, I think, was smart, but it sometimes you got to go down with the ship, and you can almost see him at times late in the fight deciding, am I just going to get knocked out or am I going to go for it? And ultimately he just got knocked out. But you're right. I think there's a lot of gas in the tank, and I think that Stevenson, people were trashing him for talking about Hopkins or Frotch, and he's 36 years old. You know, granted, he's a young 36. He's got to make his money. I think he understands that. But he also understands, hey, I'm starting to draw and I'm starting to be somebody. I don't necessarily need to fight who the fans want me to fight. I kind of want to take a few for me. I'm not sure I disagree with that.
You know, it's like what Larry Merchant said to me off the record. He said, Steve, Adonis Stevenson is now in the position of making two choices, fighting for himself with the easiest amount of money available against the biggest names, or taking the biggest risk against guys like Sergey Kovalev. Speaking of which, Sergey Kovalev, here's what I thought. I thought Ismail Salak was a live dog, and he was for about 3 minutes, and then the walls closed in, and I don't mean the Berlin Wall. Sergey Kovalev's power is real, Gabe. It's not only real, it's real scary.
He's one of those guys that's like, you know, like Stevenson has to really kind of get at you, and sometimes he can't knock you all the way out. Well, he's had some pretty scary knockouts too, but it would seem so effortless, and then the finish was so efficient. What I liked about Kovalev is I actually scored it, and I rarely do. I scored that first round like a 10-10 because I thought Kovalev was finding his range, but that neither guy was really dominating. I thought Salak was moving, but it was that kind of movement that was kind of ineffective. He'd move, he would punch, and then he would just be purely moving as opposed to kind of stepping off just a little bit and keeping you in range and keeping you honest. He seemed to be wasting energy to me. And Kovalev, I mean, when he dialed in and decided, all right, I've seen what you've got. It's probably the best you've got. And he just went in there and he finished the job. And it looks effortless. It doesn't seem like to be winding up very much. That's what makes him so scary.
Yeah, Gabe, there's an efficiency and economy of movement with Kovalev that is a little bit reminiscent of a very good friend of his, Gennady Golovkin. And rewatching the fight last night and really looking at the body language and the facial expression and the eyes of Kovalev, and again, I hope I'm not making this bad stereotypical comment, but do you remember those villains, those Russian villains in those James Bond movies, those Russian assassins that were just cold-blooded killers? That's Sergei Kovalev. Yes,
yeah.
There is a cold-blooded assassin-like mentality with this guy. I mean, I go back to the fight against Cleverly, where Cleverly hits him and he mocks him with a pelvic thrust. Ringsiders, the HBO announcers, were talking about how he was talking to Salak saying, are you basically running like a fucking Kenyan? And then when he knocked him down, he was talking trash to him. And then as he knocked him out and he's prone on the canvas, he was hovering over him, talking to him like Jerome Brown. There's a certain mean streak in this guy, where Gennady Golovkin is like this gentleman, right, this baby-faced assassin. This guy is a straight-up, and I hate to use the term killer, but he enjoys really bludgeoning people. And I got to tell you, Sergey Kovalev, I don't know if he's a man or a myth, but I want to see more. And I just find it interesting. There's so much talk of Stevenson and Kovalev. And we'll go back to your original point. I understand Stevenson's point. I'm 36. I've worked hard. I've been through a lot in my life. And quite frankly, he's put other people through a lot in their lives. But from a boxing perspective, as fight fans who have no vested interest economically in either fighter, we like to watch real fights and the best matchups. Gabe, can you name me a fight at 175 that you want to see more than Stevenson-Kovalev?
No, there's just no other fight. I mean, there's fights that, like I tweeted out after the fight, like I would watch Hopkins versus Stevenson in particular. I'm not so sure about Kovalev, although I would watch that too. But that doesn't mean I want that fight. This fight seems natural. I don't know if you can really build it any more than I mean, maybe you could, a couple more co-features so that fans really go nuts and the subscribers on HBO go nuts going, dude, put these guys in the ring together, but I just think it's the fight. It really is, and it makes sense. They both got mean streaks. I think I would lean towards Kovalev in the fight, personally. I think his main event that tweeted it out, like if you're looking at Adonis Stevenson as Fighter of the Year, and I wrote a piece stating his case as Fighter of the Year if he would win this fight with Ballou, then you need to look at Sergey Kovalev. And you really look at the year that he's had, and actually you know the year that this – Stevenson kicks off the year beating Darnell Boone, a guy that stopped him in two rounds years ago. He stopped Darnell Boone, gets his revenge. But look at Kovalev's record. He stopped Darnell Boone last year. And he's been on a nice, you know, well, he's not beating, you know, first-tier guys with every win. They're all kind of like stepping up just a little bit. They're supposed to be a little bit more of a test. He's just running right through people. So Locke should have taken him rounds. I thought he would take him the distance in losing. And some people thought he would win. And Kovalev just ices him. So I think both these guys are making not only a case for Fighter of the Year, but it's the fight of the year in 2014 right now. To me, the most dangerous fight that can be made is arguably this fight right here.
Gabe, looking at Sergey Kovalev, four fights, he only went 11 rounds, but I don't think anyone got more out of 11 rounds in any particular year in a very long time. And Yvonne Michel, I did a story late last week about how Superman is now becoming a draw. I mean, when he fought Donovan George last year, there was a couple of thousand. When he fought Chad Dawson, there was about 4,000 to 5,000. By the time he fought Divorce Cloud, there were 7,000 or 8,000, and I don't have official numbers from this past weekend, but just eyeballing the telecast, it looked like there were 8,000 to 10,000. So he is now a legitimate draw, maybe not within the realm or the stratosphere of Lucien Boutte or even Jean Pascal, but he's a draw. There's no doubt about it, at least in this country, from 168 to 175, he is a top-notch draw in North America. With that being said, he and Jim, which is Yvonne Michel, definitely have leverage. But Yvonne Michel made it very clear, Gabe, if you want to pay us Ward Rodriguez money, which was $3.15 million as a license fee, this fight can actually get done. And they will absolutely do it at that point because at that juncture, the risk versus reward pendulum, then it becomes something that's very interesting as it relates to Donna Stevenson. So my question is this, Gabe. Given the fact that Stevenson and Kovalev is not about the general public. It's about guys like me and you who do shows like this and our great audience that listens to it that are the hardcore fans. If you're HBO, knowing what they've spent for Chavez and Cotto and were basically appearance fights, do you fork out the same type of money for a fight that might be better but gets a smaller audience? That's the quandary that they have, Gabe.
That's a good question. You know, probably the answer to that is no. We do a few more shows with both of these guys on it, and we just kind of ride that gravy train. Let the fight build, let it marinate, as everybody that thinks Bob Arum is ruining the sport would detest, and then it becomes something worthwhile. Because these guys are really must see TV. These are both of these fighters. I can pull these fights and say to my MMA fans, that dig that UFC stuff. Give them this fight and say, watch these two guys, and I will have, like, fans of these guys for life. Like, they're the same guys that loved Jeff Lacy when he was knocking people out. They're kind of the casual fan that we always talk about. But that's what Kovalev and Stevenson represent. And Gennady Golovkin, to some degree. And I think Ruslan Provodnikov, you could put him in that mix as well. As guys that, they knock people out. You know, there's no flash. They don't need to throw money at the screen. We don't ooh and ah at how well they dip and duck under shots and come back with beautiful counters. We look at them because they land bombs and every punch, they're willing to risk in order to get it done. That's why we watch. I think if I'm HBO, I would spend the money and make the fight. But I don't think that's going to happen with when you throw the ratings into the equation.
Yeah, Gabe, here's the interesting thing. This telecast, which was perfect for me after the Pacquiao rebroadcast against Rios, after what was this incredibly memorable rivalry weekend, some all-time historic good games, I was able to watch fights. This telecast had 7 rounds of live boxing, and I was entertained. Sometimes mm-hmm. it is about quality over quantity. You could have your 12-round boards like Ward Rodriguez, which was an exhibition of how to win round by round of Andre Ward, which you could certainly appreciate. But when we saw two guys get laid out in professional form by ruthless guys in there who are cold-blooded, to me, that is what creates fans. Now, a point that I want to make in terms of HBO subsidizing this fight, I remember a couple of years ago under different leadership when HBO tried to manufacture a superstar in a big fight, in a quote-unquote, an important fight, out of Bradley Alexander, a fight that I was at the Silverdome. They paid a lot of money for that fight, over $4 million, if I recall correctly, with guarantees, win, lose, or draw, you're coming back on HBO. And that was so poorly conceived in every way because neither guy was very active for the past year. Well, in this situation, Gabe, as you pointed out, each guy has fought 4 times. Also, both guys were co-headlining a show before they can potentially fight. That never happened with Bradley Alexander. Also, main events led by Kathy Duva has made it very clear to me, we will fight him anywhere, even in Montreal at the Bell Center or Quebec City, so it won't be stuck out in some faraway city where no one's going to go. So if you line up the elements if HBO, which again was under a different leadership, was willing to make Bradley Alexander, this may be the new version of that fight. It'll be interesting to see what direction they go. Folks, if you want to call in, 347-215-7598. And yes, later on in the show, we will preview the HBO card and the Showtime card from the Barclays Center. Once again, 347-215-7598. Gabe, let's hit the phone lines.
All right, in the 503, you are live in the next round.
Hey, guys, it's Tyler from the OR.
What's up, man?
Question. One, who do you think is the the best kind of like spoiler, the best like fighter spoiler, kind of like an example of just like Darnell Boone. He's never really worked world champion, but he's always given like, you know, prospects, tough fights. Who do you think the guys, do you think like the best like spoiler you guys has ever seen?
Wow. You know, there was a guy by the name of Julian Wheeler who was absolutely robbed in the very last seconds against Juan Manuel Marquez years ago. He was always this tough matchup for a lot of Mexicans out here on the West Coast. He was certainly a guy. I think Glenn Johnson for a long time before he was a road warrior was certainly a spoiler.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Gabe.
No, you're good. Steve actually took my answer, so go ahead. Say Glenn Johnson, the ultimate spoiler. I remember even just while he was getting beat down by Roy Jones, looking at the HBO crew like, I got this. He's hitting me, but it's all good. And then ninth round, he's just laying on his back. It was a pretty good spoiler. I think I've seen Rockman probably had the ultimate spoiler, knocking out Lennox Lewis and laughing into the camera. No Lewis Tyson. You know, we eventually got it, but it certainly was postponed. Those off the bat are just fights that are certainly spoilers.
Yeah, and secondly, do you guys ever see Kovalev and Stevenson kind of get naked? I don't know, because after hearing Stevenson post that interview, that made me pretty weird, because it seemed like Kovalev was like fourth or fifth on the list of like potential fights.
Well, I think, Like Steve said, Kathy Duva says, we will fight anywhere to do this fight, but they're in a position where they don't necessarily have to, because she can go back and take him to NBC, they can go back to Jersey or wherever and do well probably with Kovalev at this point. But the same, but they're clearly wanting, whereas Stevenson isn't necessarily wanting. But it is weird, even the last fight when he won, and as soon as Kovalev's name's mentioned, he gets this, he's suddenly not the tough guy that he is every other time when that name's not being mentioned. You know, he kind of seems reluctant, but I think it's the reluctance of a guy with options.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing, but it's not expected. I wouldn't want to face that guy either.
Yeah, just remember this though: when fighters have options, they usually, along with their management, will take the path of least resistance. And if he's now a guy that's going to draw 8, 9, 10, 11,000 a fight, and certainly if he had his wish list of Carl Froch, Bernard Hopkins, the winner of Butte Pascal, those fights, rest assured, would draw very well in the province of Quebec. So at that point, it certainly goes down to who gives you the most amount of reward for the smallest risk. That is boxing business 101. Listen, thanks for the call. We got to get going, okay?
All right, thank you, guys.
Again, if you want to call in, 347-215-7598. If you want to tweet us a question or comment, at Steve Max Boxing, at Gabriel underscore Montoya, at Max Boxing Live. Gabe, who's next on deck?
In the 805, you're live on the next round.
Yes, who is this?
Hey, it's Marco. How's it going, guys?
Marco, what's going on?
How's it going?
Hey, good, good, good. I hope you guys had a good Thanksgiving weekend.
Yes, we did. Thank you.
Excellent. Good. Same here. So, and with respect to the fight this weekend, I thought that Ismael Salak was going to get Salak'd very early, and he did. And I just think a guy with that much talent—it's really a shame, isn't it? A guy with that much talent and skills and everything else and pedigree has a China chin, and I just kind of knew that was going to happen. With respect to Adonis, though. Don't you guys think there's a little bit, just a little tiny, I think Gabe already touched on this a few minutes ago, there's a little bit of Ikey Beabuchi in this guy in the sense that he's a little bit unpredictable. You can almost see him kind of, I hate to dispel demons on anybody, but you can almost see him getting in trouble outside the ring. And I don't know, there's something very on edge about this guy. Maybe his MO isn't quite as clear as some other fighters.
You know, as Martin Lawrence once said, crazy, deranged, maybe. Well, listen, we all know about his past. And as his stature and profile grow, that story of his past, whether he likes it or not, will only get bigger, and it'll only get more exposed, unfortunately. But you know what? He did what he did, and I look at it in two ways. Your past, in certain respects, never escapes you, and you do something of that nature, maybe it should never escape you. But also at the same time, boxing is all about redemption, and if he served his time to society, then we let him move on and to have a second chance. So it works both ways, but I don't look at him as Ike Ibiabuchi. Ike was a seriously crazy guy, though. I know people that had dealings with him in the late 90s. Lou DiBella can tell you about a story where he was at a steakhouse and he thought he was going to get carved up right up on that table by Ike Ibiabuchi. It's one of the best stories I've ever heard. But I do think he's an exuberant guy. But you know what? I've always said this, Marco. To be a boxer, you got to be a little bit crazy. I mean, just think about the sheer nature of what you're doing for a living.
Yeah, without question. They're all a little different. You know, each one, even the ones that seem completely normal. Like, I would say, like, Mikey Garcia is one of the most, like, calm, rational dudes you ever want to talk to. Then you see him in the ring. I mean, he's just a cold-blooded, calculated killer. He just takes people out. And he's not, you don't see him ease up. You see him going in there for the knockout. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with him. It's just there's a reason why we three are talking about them, and they're fighters. Everybody's a little bit different. And I think Adonis, I don't think he hasn't shown that he loses control in the ring. That's one thing I'll give him, you know. But out of the ring, it's just a personal choice. Who's going to be, you know, how do you feel about him? You know, are you going to watch him? There's a lot of fighters, and I wrote a little piece about it this weekend and just talking about, there's a long list. I mean, Paul Spadafora was fighting this weekend, as our webmaster pointed out. He's had issues, you know, shooting his pregnant girlfriend. Derek Chisora, he's had domestic violence issues with women. It all comes down to how far do you want to separate yourself, you know, from what they did in the real world and sports, which we just enjoy watching.
I guess where I'm going with that is those kinds of personality things. And honestly, I knew nothing about Adonis's past. This is just kind of something that, until just recently, this is something I've always noticed about him. There was always something a little bit on edge about him that way. But
yeah,
those kinds of personalities, you know, sort of character flaws, if you want to call them, eventually surface in the ring at some point, especially during you know, sort of dire situations. He's pretty much had his way in the past, you know, in the past year with his opponents, pretty much with very, very little resistance on the other end. What happens when he does fight somebody like Kovalev? And the reason I say that is because he seems to be the stark opposite of him from a personality standpoint. I mean, he's actually a little bit goofy when you sort of hear his post-fight interviews and things. You know, he's got that smile, and he's a little bit disarming with that. Very, very similar, you know, in terms of, you know, that mean streak that you have to have inside the ring, but I think they're completely different guys outside the ring. I just think that from a character standpoint, those kinds of things are going to show up in the ring where it counts the most.
Well, Marco, you obviously subscribe, and so do I, to the Teddy Atlas rationale, that if you're a fractured individual and if you're not solid and steady from a psychological standpoint, you will literally unravel in the ring. And could that be the case with Adonis Stevenson if he faces Kovalev? I would certainly like to find out, like a lot of other people.
I would tend to think that he would. Just look at the way he reacts to the name. He doesn't. Manny Pacquiao kind of just keeps an even keel when you ask him who he wants to fight next, and everybody wants him to say Mayweather, and he just defers to the normal line. But his emotions don't change. His face doesn't change. Chito Trinidad used to say do the same thing. People seem to forget that, and that's a standard answer. Manny didn't invent it. You know, talk to my promoter. That's the one that's in charge. But when Kovalev was brought up to Stevenson, he gets a little nervous. He gets a little tight. And whether he's a guy with options or not, it's something that we should pay attention to, because you're right. I mean, and he's a guy that, you know, I mean, he did it, so we can talk about it. I mean, there were crimes against females, people he could dominate, people that are weaker than him. And he likes to you can see it when he sees weakness in his opponent. He feeds off of it. I don't think Kovalev gives him any of that, and that it's going to be interesting to see how he handles that.
Yeah. Marco, listen, we got to run, okay?
Can't wait to see it. Talk to you later, guys.
Thanks a lot. A couple of tweets here from V.A. Fogg, our good friend. Steve, don't hate on the Silverdome. It's the house that Barry Sanders built and tore apart. Brian, I disagree. It's the house that Billy Sims built, and it was the house that Bobby Ross tore down. Also, from Linus SQ, talking about the Russian assassin in the Bond movies, Max Zorin, if you do a kill, maybe a bad example, although Stevenson is meaner than Grace Jones. And here's one from our good friend Joshua. Is Cotto leaning to Canelo or Martinez? Gabe, I really don't know. I've been told that the HBO top-ranked side feel pretty confident coming back from Macau. But I will say this, in talking to a couple people that are really involved in that situation, that supposed rumored $15 million offer for Miguel Cotto to face Sergio Martinez, I wouldn't put one penny stock into that. Because if you look at the math and the way pay-per-view money is distributed and what the projected pay-per-view sales are, Gabe, I don't think there's any way either fighter, unless Sergio Martinez is fighting for pennies, I don't think there's any way Sergio Martinez is allowing the guy without the title to make $15 million.
I mean, it depends on how much they're giving Sergio, but I just don't see how they would – that the fight is so lucrative that they would throw $15 million to make Miguel change his mind. To me, if you're throwing Miguel $10 million to face Canelo and you're in a real war with Top Rank and Golden Boy, you know, if you're Top Rank, you go, okay, overspend, do another pay-per-view. Let's see your company – I would rather let my the other company spend that money and maybe even take it in the wallet a little bit, rather than try to outbid them. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me, that they would throw $15 million at him. I mean, maybe Martinez would say, all right, I'm going to take 5 or 7, but is there that much money on the table? You know, is there that much money available in that fight? Again, I don't think so. But it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. When I heard $15 million, I was like, it sounds like somebody just said that on a message board and somebody ran with it, you know, but it doesn't seem like a real offer to me.
I mean, Cotto Martinez, I think, is a real legitimate pay-per-view fight. But does it do a million? I mean, I don't even think it does as much as Mayweather-Guerrero, which, depending on who you want to believe and what agenda you want to believe, it did $850 to $1 million. To pay a guy who'd be basically the challenger, but still the draw, $15 million. Again, I've been told by more than one boxing insider, the math simply does not work. Here's one from Eric Grimey. Who does Danny Swift-Garcia fight next? You know, Gabe, I've got to be honest. I have no clue. I haven't heard a damn thing.
And they've been dead silent. I think they're kind of waiting for things to shake out a little bit because, you know, Danny's had a lot of things asked of him, and he's answered them all. But I think the next one could be a little easier for him, and maybe he's waiting. He's going to move up to 47. That's at least what I've heard. So, and it's what he said, you know. So Judah Malignaggi, the winner of that fight, does he take that guy on? You know, that's certainly viable. It's something that I would see the Judah rematch. I thought Judah did really good in the end of that fight. And I thought both guys would make for a better fight having had that long look at each other. They both found weaknesses. They found things. You know, Danny, I thought, got better, and then he got worse in the fight. Judah was getting outboxed, and he got better late in the fight. Maybe that was his last hurrah. We'll find out this weekend with Pauly what he's got left, but I tend to favor him in that. But I think that's certainly a viable candidate. Other than that, he's going to have to start looking around and going, well, what are they making for me? I mean, does he take the Broner Maidana winner? I mean, that's a possibility for him. But, you know, I don't know. It depends on how much do they value him. Do they want him to be a star, or do they want Adrian Broner at all costs to be a star? Because he certainly feels like it.
My gut feel, and again, I have no inside info here, I think they want to remain undefeated and be right in the front of the line for the Mayweather sweepstakes in the second half of 2014. And here's one from Robert Palmer.
Yeah.
What's your pick for Darren Barker versus Felix Sturm? Will there be any U.S. TV? Also, what's the latest on Danny Garcia? We just talked about that. Gabe, I'll say this. I think Barker wins this fight, but it's in Germany, so I have no idea if he's going to get the decision.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, and Barker looks good right now, but it's also depends on, you know, how much is Felix Sturm going to stand and trade. He started to stand and trade just a little bit more each fight. And against a guy like Barker, that could be a problem. I mean, I think Daniel Gill was was a good style for Barker. What he does kind of played into Barker's hands, and it was a really tough, close fight. Stern doesn't really play it, if at his best, doesn't play into what Darren Barker does, but I tend to think that Barker's just a little fresher. I lean towards him, but, yeah, like you said, I mean, you have to kill Felix Sturm in order to get a draw in Germany, so...
If Sturm was a carton of milk, the sell-by date was 3 weeks ago. I think Barker is a fighter really near his physical and athletic prime. I think Felix Sturm has seen better days. If you want to call in, 347-215-7598. Gabe, who's next on deck?
In the 347, you're live on the next round.
Yeah, hi, good evening, guys. This is Amilcar. How are you doing?
Amilcar, what can we do for you?
How you doing, man?
I'm pretty good, thanks. All this talk about the Kovalev and Stevenson matchup, I'm really thinking that what I'd like to hear is which one of these two guys would be facing Andre Ward, because I really don't see anyone else for him to fight. What do you think about that?
Gabe?
Andre's going to have to make a move at some point. I mean, I know he's the man and everything at 168, but I would like to know what he's like at 175. And I think, you know, I'm not going to take back my pick or say, oh, I was I'm not going to denigrate it at this point. But, you know, Rodriguez and Dawson are two guys that came down in weight to 68. It was their choice, not taking anything away from Andre. But let's see him face a guy that's either strong at 68. Groves would be an interesting fight. I'm not sure if you should take that next. I'd like to see him conquer Frotch completely and not get a weird stoppage and then fight Ward. But that's an interesting matchup for him. I don't think Andre would travel. I think Groves would. But barring that, I think it's time for Andre to move up. I mean, greatness is either going to be longevity, and at 168, staying there forever, I just don't see him having a Hopkins-like career, you know, that we really care about. He's just run out of people. But at 175, there are challenges, and greatness is all about overcoming challenges. That's what I want to see Ward do.
Amilcar and Gabe, let me just make this statement as president of the Andre Ward fan club. It seems to me, okay, it just my personal perspective, that he's going to stay at 68 as long as humanly possible, and he's going to try to campaign and fool the public into thinking that him and Chavez is a fight that we should be willing to pay on pay-per-view. It's as clear as day. And let's be honest, if Ward fought Chavez, even if he had one arm tied behind his back, maybe two for the even rounds and the odd rounds he gets to use just one hand, I think he would still win every round of that fight. But he is still under the impression that he could fool the public and sell this snake oil that somehow I'm a star yet trying to piggyback off of Chavez. That's what he's trying to do. And I don't know if it's ever going to happen. I don't think it's going to work. But until he actually moves up to 75, Amilcar, I don't think there's anything to talk about.
Well, that's what I think Gabe and I want to see, because I just don't see anyone at 168 that poses any semblance of a threat. And at least at 175, we've got two guys here that I see anyways have the ability to knock him out cold. And, that's what I'd like to see. So, I mean, that's what, you know, is behind my question. I'd like to see him in a competitive fight.
He doesn't want to see that. He wants to see, like what Steve said, I agree with you, Steve. I think it is the writing's on the wall. He's entered the let's get paid phase. You know, his Super 6 was what De La Hoya's 147 was. Let me run a gauntlet, and now after that, let me get paid. And it's not really – although Oscar did take very competitive fights in his old age to take on Floyd Mayweather, or his older age, and Manny Pacquiao. That's admirable. De La Hoya has nothing to be ashamed of with his career. But this is where Andre is now. He wants the biggest money, highest reward, lowest risk, and he's going to still continue to tell me he's great. And that's, you know, it's like when they were doing the Kelly Pavlik fight. To me, it always seemed strange, too, that they didn't want the Lucien Boutte fight. That seemed an easier fight, but they didn't want that because he just wasn't that good anyways, is what Virgil Hunter said to me. He's like, see, after he lost, like, you know, we didn't need to face him because he wasn't that good. I just don't live in that world. So I think that's what we're going to see. We're probably not going to see him move to 75. He says these guys aren't going to put him in Floyd Mayweather territory. I kind of tend to agree with him. You know, avoiding them will, but fighting them won't.
Amil Carr, is there anything else we could do for you?
Not at all. I'm just going to enjoy the show before the Seahawks take on the Saints. So, as always, thanks a lot.
Amil Carr, thank you for joining us. Gabe, who's next on deck here?
Special guest star Dave Duenas in the 209. Dave.
What's up, fellas? How you guys doing?
David Duenas, what's going on?
Hey, listen, really quick with the Adonis Stevenson background. I think here's the difference is that Adonis, he's not repeating or trying to repeat what his background has been shown in the past, like not like an Adrian Broner. I think age has something to do with it, you know, where he knows what he wants to get to and he knows where he's going with. But, Steve, this is my question to you. This is a fight, really, honestly, in a long time where you can kind of look at the Hearns and Hagler type of feel to it. So main events has always been really good in how to direct things and then making it much bigger than what it is. Why do you think that Kathy Du was saying we'll make it happen anytime, anywhere, when really they shouldn't make it happen to the end of 2014 until they build the fighter?
You know why? I think there's two things. Number one, I don't think they really think that the economic payoff would be that much greater if you waited two or three fights. I also think, number one, Kathy thinks she has the winner. So trust me, usually the side that thinks that they're going to come out on top, they will usually push for that fight a little bit harder. That's very consistent, okay? But I also think that they look at Adonis Stevenson at age 36, no matter what we think of how many miles he has left, they say, wait a minute, he's 36. What if he has a really, really bad night and that fight becomes devalued? And I think that's another thing that they're afraid of. And, you know, I was communicating with Kathy on Saturday night, and I said, Kathy, do you want this fight next? She says, absolutely. We want this fight next. Because, again, it's one thing if both guys were in their mid-20s. They're not. Kovalev is 30. Adonis Stevenson is 36. So is there time to make the fight? Yes, but there isn't forever, Dave.
You know what I like about the fight, too, is that for Emmanuel Stewart, his nephew's training, Stevenson, if any time in any way you want to be in the same breath of your uncle, this is the fight that you need. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing. And sadly, you know, I think part of Emmanuel's history is that he got to that pinnacle with Hearns in two fights and lost them. I think Lennox and Vladimir were his final masterpieces. And he got some redemption, I think, in big fights. But they never really had that. You know, they didn't get Tyson in his prime. I think maybe the Vitaly fight was kind of their big swan song. But Sugar Hill, I mean, his legacy is going to be his own. But in my opinion, in this big fight, and I do agree with you, it's got all that same feel. I think they're going to come up with the loser in this one. It'll be kind of historically ironic.
Yeah, because Stevenson, he still does a lot of there's a lot of amateur stuff. I mean, for a guy that I mean, he stalks. He doesn't know how to step out his leading foot on the outside. He does things where
he gets a little desperate. He leaps forward,
very desperate in what he does.
But just remember this, guys. Are there things he has to learn? Yes. But does he do things you can't teach, which is power? Absolutely.
No.
He has an eraser.
Yeah.
I mean, Tony Bellew had a pretty decent game plan. Even though that wasn't necessarily his ring identity, he tried to give himself the best chance to win. And he might have done that, except he was overpowered. He was simply outgunned. And the type of power and speed that Adonis Stevenson retains at age 36, it is his best weapon, and it does camouflage a lot of those other technical flaws.
And my last question, really quick, before I get off and all that, is I'm getting a lot of emails from Leaving the Ring Radio. How come Steve Kim and Henry Ramirez haven't done a college and pro football radio show yet?
Well, Dave, I'll be honest. People barely listen to what I say about boxing. They're certainly not going to listen to what I have to say about football. I'll be dead honest about that.
You know, my older brother goes, you know, he said, I rarely listen to what Steve says about boxing, but I love to hear what he has to say about the college ball.
Hey, let me just say something. From my couch, I have never lost a football game coaching it. I'm undefeated to this day.
Don't let Floyd Mayweather hear that.
Oh, God. Anyway, David, listen, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right, Ben.
Gabe, let's get on to round number two. Let's preview the HBO show from Atlantic City, New Jersey, a triple header on tap here. Mm. The main event for the junior featherweight title, Guillermo Rigondeaux takes on Joseph Agbeko. Then in a junior middleweight attraction, Glenn Tapia, undefeated at 20-0, 12 knockouts, takes on the return of James Kirkland with a record of 31-1-1. And in the middleweight feature, Matthew Macklin, coming off his loss to Gennady Golovkin, takes on late replacement Lamar Russ. Gabe, do you give Agbeko any shot against the Cuban stylist?
I give him a shot to maybe go the distance. I don't really give him a chance. I mean, it doesn't sound like he's in a really, like, stable fighting place, training place. I mean, maybe he's training and he's in great shape, but the mental aspects and the promotional stuff, the money he owes, I never like to hear a guy is really fighting because he needs the money. That's, you know, then he's not really looking at, can I win? He's not looking at all the things that are advantageous to him. He's fighting from a place of desperation. And some guys, that's great. I'm not sure, but I've always thought highly of Agbeko. He's got an awkward style. He's a former world champion, and he's got very good skills. He's got decent power. He could be a problem, but I just think Rigondeaux is that good. I don't think he stops Agbeko, but I think he does thoroughly outbox him.
I think Joseph Agbeko has that classic Ghanaian toughness, durability, and chin. I think it goes the distance. But one thing I found puzzling, Agbeko training with Roger Mayweather, only thing that really ensures is that he's practiced the same combination a million times, that he's never going to get off against Rigondeaux. I think Rigondeaux wins a very wide decision. Gabe, I think the fight of the night on either card of HBO or Showtime in terms of pure action, I think is Tapia Kirkland. And when this fight was first signed, I didn't know where Kirkland was at, literally and physically and mentally. I didn't know who he was training with at that point. But now that he's back with Ann Wolf, because the grass is not greener on the other side of the fence, I now think James Kirkland, Mandingo Warrior, I think he beats Glenn Tapia.
You know, I knew where he was. He was in East Austin, and he was training. And he was in very good shape for quite a while there before he signed with 50 Cent. He was, I think, really getting ready for free agency. He was waiting for his contract to end. He knew he was on hold. He was literally starving. I mean, he's like, I don't know how to pay my bills. I don't know when we get done here. But he had some ideas of where he wanted to go. And I think there was interest from Tyson. 50 went out, and then he went up to San Jose to train with Bob Santos. Lasted about 2 weeks when he got knocked down against Sean Porter in the ring. I wrote about that on Max Boxing. And he went to Ann Wolf, and Ann took him back in. You know, she says she doesn't raise fighters so much as you know, good citizens, good adults. And she's raised him in the gym from a long time, like the age 9 or so. And she welcomed him back like a family member. She said, one, it was the strongest mentally she'd ever seen him, or at least lately, coming into a training camp. And physically, it was the best he'd been in years. He was like 168, 165, somewhere in there. He was in really good shape. And I saw him. He was in really good shape. And they have 5 weeks to get ready together. And I think that, for me, like you, it changed everything, how I feel. And like Linus, one of our guys, tweeted at us that he thinks, like the caller Marco was talking about, that Kirkland will unravel in the ring. And I got to be honest, there's no evidence to suggest that. Where Kirkland unravels is generally outside the
life.
Ring. Before.
Real life.
Yeah. But in the ring, I mean, you look back to the Aussie Duran fight, where I think he got like 8 rounds of sparring or 6. Was living in his car for that fight, made weight terribly. And you could see him find his way through that fight. And as the fight went along, he actually got better and stronger. And against Carlos Molina, where he looked awful and he had another weight issue, he was very heavy, like close to 200 pounds or more in that camp. You could see him later in the fight, even though it looked terrible throughout, he legitimately dropped Carlos Molina. Arguably could have been on his way to a stoppage. We don't know. Probably not. But he got better as the fight goes on. James is incredibly strong mentally. It's his judgment outside the ring that's the problem. It's never really been so much inside the ring.
You know, you look at Glenn Tapia, and he's been developed slowly and steadily and surely by Top Rank. Never been in a real dogfight. And there's one thing about Kirkland.
Yeah.
if anyone wants to doubt his constitution, I'm telling you, the Angulo fight said it all. He was literally decked in the first 15 seconds, out on his feet for 30 seconds, and he turned it around and thumped Angulo. You can say a lot of things about Kirkland. Most of them probably aren't all that complimentary. The guy is a dog, and I don't mean as an acquitter, but as in a Doberman. And with Ann Wolf, I've said it before, certain trainers and fighters belong to each other. This here is peaches and herb. They are reunited, and I think it's going to feel very good. I think Kirkland is back where he belongs. As for Macklin Lamar Russ,
by the way.
Yeah, Gabe, Macklin Lamar Russ, the shame of it all, I was one of the very few people. I wanted to see Willie Nelson in there with Macklin because I thought one way or the other someone was going to hit the floor. And now as it relates to Lamar Russ, again, this is what happens when HBO or Showtime, mostly HBO, starts promising return fights for guys like Macklin, who I like, for basically being sacrificed for Gennady Golovkin. This is what you get stuck with.
Yeah, you buy fights, not fighters. That's, you know, I mean, I guess this is the last of those kind of contracts. I don't know how many more of these obligations they have left, but like you said, you know, somebody's going to get knocked down. Although, you know, Russ has never been stopped, so, and he's a young guy.
Big kid, too, Gabe. Big kid, good size.
Yeah, 6'2", you know. And Macklin, we'll see what he's got left. I mean, this to me is always what boxing is really about, is a guy, you know, he's undefeated. Nobody really knows anything about him. He gets called up. He's apparently, you know, ready to go and in shape. And he answers the call. You know, he's fought three times this year, so he's not rusty. He certainly hasn't fought this level of competition, but he's a prospect, you know, maybe a suspect. We're about to find out if he's the real deal. And that's, to me, that is what this sport is all about. It's like the human lottery.
All right, let's get back to the phone lines. If you want to call in, 347-215-7598. Gabe, who's next on the queue?
We're going overseas. 011-66. It's you. You're live on the next round.
Yo, this
Hello?
Is Lewis from Scotland. Can you hear me?
Chris, how are you?
Hey, what's up, guys? Good show as always. I've just got two questions, if that's okay, and I'll get out of here.
Go ahead.
What's up? What's on your mind?
Yeah, man. Just about Errol Spence Jr. How do you guys think his career is progressing? I've been watching some of his fights, and I know he's 9-0, but the first 8 fights, I think, were just pointless. And his last fight was pretty good. He went 8 rounds with Emmanuel Latte. What do you guys think of his career so far and his progression?
Well, you know, we could rip his strength of schedule, but, you know, this is the way careers are developed nowadays. This is not the UFC where you're going to have guys who are 7-5 in main events. I think that out of last year's Olympic team, the two guys that I've been impressed with most out of the gate right now are Errol Spence and JoJo Diaz, the young bantamweight. I think Errol Spence is very sharp, and I thought he took a significant step up when he fought the Ghanaian out of New York in his last fight that actually buzzed him, I think, in the 7th round. I've always said, with blue-chip prospects like that, or any prospects, the first dozen or so fights are on the house. You're not going to be matched all that tough. And they're developmental stepping stone fights. I don't think he's being developed any differently than a lot of other champions have been for the past 30, 40 years in the sport of boxing, Gabe.
No, and I think in a sense, I mean, they've gone easy on him in a bit. With the first 8-9 fights are kind of confidence builders, or they're almost like, you know, sparring sessions, in the sense that, like, if you go to one sparring session, like I saw Kirkland Porter, just one for both of those guys, I can't really comment on everything they did in camp. I mean, James looked good for that camp and seems very confident, but, you know, one is not going to tell you everything. And these fights, you know, that day they may be working on one thing, and this fight, you know, these different fighters, they're probably brought in for a specific reason, for him to work on a certain something, and then he does and he executes. To me, he's not going the distance with these guys. That's a good sign. I like that he did go the distance in his last fight. That's probably what he was for. The guy was undefeated, had 15 wins, one draw. He's, you know, he had to teach that guy how to lose, and he did it over 8 rounds. But you have to remember, Errol Spence also had those WSB fights. He's one of those guys. And those are higher, that's higher level experience than everybody else gets. So just turning pro, I think he's right where he needs to be. It's hard to say that he's prospect of the year because of the level of competition, but I certainly think he's on his way to next year. He's certainly somebody to keep an eye on. He's my favorite out of the class. I mean, there's a few guys I like in that, you know, but
and
I really
guys,
like him a lot.
Guys, I just want to make this point. Another guy that I'm really sky high on and have a chance to be the next Puerto Rican star is Felix Verdejo. And you know what? He's not exactly facing Murderer's Row or Monsters of the Midway. This is the way it's done in boxing. Your first 10 to 15 fights, the variable being age and amateur experience, you're not going to really fight a quote-unquote real guy till at least you're on that HBO level. And far as I'm concerned, if you're not on HBO or Showtime, you know what? And if you're not taking up these valuable slots, getting all this money for it, I don't think fans should have that much of a problem in terms of the matchmaking early on of these prospects.
No, I think with these guys, too, I mean, Golden Boy has opened up a new series, and we're getting to see these guys a little bit earlier than maybe we would have.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I'll ask my second question. But I agree with you about Errol Spence. I do, but the thing is, I don't see the point in having like four first-round knockouts in a row. I know the guys get matched easy early, but, you know, it is what it is, I suppose. It's just
I agree
a way
with
of making money. But, yeah, my second question is I go to boxing matches a lot, and I always see the same faces there. Like in attendance, I'm sure as boxing writers you always see the same fans there as well. In other sports like soccer and basketball, and I'm sure you do it in American football as well, you have season tickets, you have some kind of discount for the fans. I'm just wondering why boxing doesn't do something like that for the fans, where if I buy a ticket for a promoter show, why can't I get a cheaper ticket for the next show the promoter does, you know? Some kind of thing to give back to the fans, because I think the way the promoters treat the fans is a little bit disrespectful. I just wanted to see if, I know you guys talk about promoters and, like, how good they are. Like, I know you guys don't like Gary Shaw, for example. What do you guys think of the format of promotion in 2013?
Well, I've written about how fans should have more access to the real tickets. In terms of a season ticket or a frequent buyer program, it's a little bit hard because there's no set schedule. I mean, in the NBA, you have 82 games. In National Football League, you get 16. Boxing's a little bit different. I do think the one thing I really like about the UFC that I'm told that they do, they have a program where if you buy tickets on a regular basis, you're part of this program, you put some money in, you do get first dibs at tickets on a consistent basis. But even then, Gabe, I heard it's really not worth the purchase. So I don't know what you can really do. I mean, listen, you know what you're getting into as it relates to boxing, and I've always said, buyer beware.
Yeah, I could be wrong on that. This is a theory, but every fight can be priced differently. So you're kind of killing, how much money you can make if I'm Golden Boy, say, or even just Top Rank, and say this is, you can buy in and you're going to get premium tickets and we're just going to put it at this price point and maybe just overcharge. But then also, if I'm that guy then buying that, and let's say I get I want to go to the Pacquiao fight, but then the undercard's garbage, am I really getting value for money just so I can see Manny, basically shut a guy out? It's a really strange market. I just think until we ensure quality across the board, and that's always hard to do because it's just styles make fights, and some guys, like even with Errol Spence, maybe some of those guys were meant to go rounds, and he's just icing people in one or two rounds because he's that good. That does happen. Kathy Duva was trying to get rounds for Curtis Stevens, and he was taking people out. But I think it's just because it's so – there isn't no boxing schedule. There's dates that they have to fill. It's going to be hard for that to happen. But I agree with you. When UFC has that kind of plan, and it does seem to work, but they're also more in control of the fights that they make.
Yeah, guys, just before I go, I know you guys are busy. Can I just add that the reason why I say season tickets is because in American football, soccer, the teams use that money to reinvest in the sport, reinvest in the team. And I just think if you have some kind of money up front, at least the guys can reinvest in the sport. I don't see any promoters reinvesting at the grassroots level in boxing. I don't see any inner city gyms opening up because of the promoters, you know. And at least then, if you had some kind of schedule or some kind of things that would maybe make it more attractive to TV and maybe make it more attractive to fans. But guys, thanks for your time again, man.
All right, listen, we got to get going. Thanks for the call. I don't know what to really say. That's a perfect utopian concept. Folks, we talk boxing here. I mean, again, one thing about boxing compared to UFC, most of the money goes to the talent. So at that point, why don't you ask the talent, why aren't you reinvesting in the sport? Folks.
I agree with you. It's sort of like what I wrote about with testing this weekend, and not to do a show about Andre Ward, but he sat there and denigrated Edwin Rodriguez, like, oh, it's just a publicity stunt, when it really isn't. The guy signed up for it, and, you know, Tim Bradley's doing testing, so is Provodnikov, same company. They're not in league with Victor Conte. To me, like I wrote in this weekend, the sport is so fractured, you've got to find your places to clean up, but also the ways that the fighters can band together and protect themselves and each other. They should be looking to do that. They should be looking to put their bargaining power, their financial power together in order to get over, in order to get some equality. Because a lot of times they're not making as much as the promoters are, and they probably should be, even though the model is probably better over here financially for them than it is for UFC fighters. But it's just like I tell the consumers, you know, don't buy, you don't like bad pay-per-views, don't buy them. And I think with the boxers, you don't like the way the things are run, and you think the system's against you, find ways to overcome it instead of just, you know, rather than just looking to get yours. Look for everybody to get theirs, and maybe they will.
Yeah, and Gabe, no website, specifically this writer right here, has talked about the issue of tickets, the brokering of tickets, how fans get screwed, and how to keep from being screwed and to play the system as this website. But again, when you ask for season tickets and all that, you know, again, we don't run the sport. We cover it. And we brought up the issues, but, you know, I don't even know what to say. We don't live in a perfect world. 347-215-7598. Gabe, who's next on the queue?
You've been on the longest. 843, you're live on the next round. 843, you there?
And we have our first knockdown of the night. Who's next, Gabe?
in Vegas, the 702, you're live on the next round. 702, you're live on the next round. And our second knockdown of the night. Looking around for the seven. I'm trying to make sure I don't pull somebody up twice. 510, you're live on the next round. 510? Wow, three knockdowns in a row. 860, you're live on the next round.
Yeah, how you guys
860.
Yes, who is this?
Hey, how you doing?
CT calling from Philly. How you doing?
Good. What's going on?
How you doing, CT?
Pretty good. How are you, Gabe?
I'm doing good, man.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that triple header this weekend. I agree with you guys. I'm looking forward to the Glenn Tapia and James Kirkland fight. The reason being because I think Glenn Tapia is a live underdog. I think he's very well-rounded. But as you guys know, Kirkland's one of those rare, you know, empire-type tenacity fighters, who's one of those fighters that's going to take it to a dark place. And I think Glenn Tapia hasn't been there yet, you know. He's got that type of fortitude that's going to test your manhood all through the fight. Now, you know, it's interesting to see where Glenn Tapia goes from there, because I think Kirkland's going to have that type of, you know, pressure and power that Glenn Tapia has never seen before. And I think he's going to well underneath the pressure and he's going to get knocked down late.
I think the key to this fight is this. James Kirkland is a little bit shitty, but it's not a lack of toughness. He's been in dogfights. The question is, how will Glenn Tapia handle a real relentless attack? And I don't mean a winging left hook from my cousin, A.B. Hahn, who had no clue, okay? A.B. Hahn was very tough, but he was just incredibly ill-taught. James Kirkland is a pro. He's seasoned. He's hardened. He's been through things. I just wonder, how will he handle the heat in the kitchen, Gabe, come the fourth and fifth round? That to me, is the biggest question mark.
Yeah, I mean, James takes you to those places. That's why I don't really understand the logic that he would unravel. He doesn't unravel. You have to stop him. When Ishida dropped him three times, he had to be tackled in order to be stopped. And then Joe Cortez jumped on him. He wasn't going to stop. I don't think his body was ready in that fight. But I think his body's right. I think James is really scary right now because of the fact that he's so hungry. He knows this is Last Chance Saloon. Like, he gets it. He may not even be an opponent after this if he gets blown out. So he has to win. And Glenn is in a place that's brand new. He's now in a fight. When they first made it, he was in a place where this guy's been off for a long time. He's chinny. He can be outboxed. He's perfect for you. And then he goes to Ann Wolf for 5 weeks. And that probably changes things for the matchmakers. I know there was one person in the industry whose opinion I really respect about Glenn Tapia and James Kirkland, who just flat out said that changed my opinion of the fight. And they worry a little bit about Glenn now. Whereas they thought that they were getting the right James Kirkland. I agree with you guys. I think it's hard for me to say Tapia gets stopped late, but I tend to think that he does. Really, the first few seconds will show us what James is like. If he comes out fast, remember he came out sluggish against Carlos Molina, and I remember 30 seconds in just going, uh-oh, he's done. He's not the normal James. But look at him, even with Angulo getting dropped, got back up. He was incredibly relentless. He was conditioning. So I think the first few moments are going to say a lot. And like Steve said, after the fourth round, if Tapia's got, starting to put it on James and is still right there, then we're going to find out what kind of depth of character he has and what he can take. If not, it's going to be a short night.
Yeah, about the Beko and Rigondeaux fight, I just think it's a little bit too late for Beko. I think his best years are a little bit behind him. Even though I do think he has a very good straight right hand, that he's shown, especially against Chinny and stuff like that. But I just think Rigondeaux is on a whole other level. This guy is very, very skilled in the ring. And I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest with you, if he stops the Beko. I just think he's very quick on his counter punching. He's so accurate, and he's got a lot of power, especially when he goes to the body. We see him take people on the body shots. So it'll be interesting to see how Rigondeaux goes at this fight. I don't give the Beko a chance at all. But I would definitely, if Rigondeaux does pull it off, which I expect him to do, where he goes from here. Don't see too many challenges at 122, unless they break that promotional war. But either that, or both for 126, which I don't think going anytime soon.
I'll say this, Gabe. I don't know if you agree with me. Rigo's going to win this fight, barring a bolt of lightning hitting him on the way to the ring. But there are certain fights, it's not if you win, it's how you win. And it's not just enough, in my opinion, based on what Rigo is facing, the uphill climb, the hurdles he has to face. It's not if he wins, is he going to be able or willing to press the gas pedal and be the first guy to stop Agbeko? I know Agbeko's long in the tooth. I know he's only had one fight this year in a very long time, in March, 12-round decision over Luis Melendez. But if he impressively halts Joseph Agbeko, he topples King Kong, that's an impressive victory. That will get people to say, wait a minute, this Rigo guy, he may not be who we thought he was. He may be more than just this Cuban stinker who wants to win trophies 12-0. I think he should actually go for the stoppage if the opportunity presents itself.
I agree. And you really look at his fights, and people think of him as kind of a stinker. He's had three decision fights, the Nair fight, Marroquin, and Cordoba, and they weren't the most exciting fights. I mean, he had one other decision against Lantiati, but they weren't the most exciting things. But Rigo was an aggressive guy who was looking to hurt you. He was a power puncher. And I think in this fight, one, stopping anybody from Ghana is always an accomplishment. They're just incredibly tough fighters. But also, you have to take into account that Agbeko really is an 18, and Rigo is really an 18. So that's going to be interesting, even though the statures are a little bit off by a few inches. He's fighting a guy that really is in the same weight class. I always think of Rigo as fighting out of his weight class in order to get good fights. So I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. And like CT pointed out, I have a good feeling it will be to the body, that straight left to the body.
All right, listen, thanks for the call. We got to run, okay?
All right, thanks so much.
Gabe, let's preview the show from the Barclay Center presented by Showtime. In the main event, the Brooklyn Battle, welterweights in action, Paulie Malignaggi against Zab Super Judah. For the IBF welterweight title, Devin Alexander takes on upstart Sean Porter. Then in the junior middleweight clash, Arizlani Lara takes on Austin Trout. And for the WBC super middleweight crown, Saki Obika faces Anthony Durrell. Gabe, I don't know if you agree or disagree with me, but people are saying that Malignaggi Judah is happening about 3 or 4 years too late. I disagree. I think right now, based on where they're at, I think the fight is actually much more appealing now, and based on the fact that I think we're going to get a much better fight than we would have 3, 4 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the timing is everything, and both have had interesting careers, and that I thought that Paulie was done a while ago, and he's had a resurgence. People thought Judah was done. They want him to be done. He's turning out to be one of those fighters that no matter how many losses he has, he's a guy that we enjoy watching, and I rarely am bored by Zab Judah. I enjoy talking to him when we do interviews or listening to him talk in interviews. He obviously has passion and pride. And he shows up and he displays it. I mean, he certainly displayed that in the back end of the Garcia fight. And that's generally what I want from a prize fighter. The minute I see a guy just kind of in there dogging it and just marking time and getting a paycheck, that's the time you need to pull that guy out, and it's the time I generally don't want to see him anymore. Zab Judah hasn't hit that point, and Paulie hasn't hit that point yet. I thought he did really good in the Broner fight and probably didn't get as much credit as he should have because he doesn't have much power. So I think this fight's happening at just the right time.
You know, I think Zab, the last quarter of that fight against Danny Garcia, after he got knocked down, I believe, in the 8th round, I think he pulled himself up by the bootstraps and said, you know what, if I want to be a guy that's not going to be on Fox Sports 1 or ESPN 2, I better make a fight out of this. And you know what, he did. And I don't know if it's an upset, I don't know the odds, I don't really follow him that closely. I think Zab Judah is going to win this fight, Gabe. I think he's got every bit as much speed. Paulie Malignaggi, we know, is not a power puncher by any stretch of the imagination. And I think Zab Judah will always have quick, fast, powerful hands. I'm going to take Zab Judah to win this fight. And I think Paulie, based on the fact that he's talked about it openly, I think he might even retire after this fight.
That's the thing with Paulie, is that he does talk about, he has such a love-hate relationship with the business, that it does make you question it. I was looking over some of the conference call quotes and some of the press stuff, and a lot of it was him talking about, well, when I signed the fight, you know, when I decide to fight, you know, I'm going to camp and I have no second, you know, I train wholeheartedly and I'm into it. But a guy that's having to talk himself into the fight, that's somebody that's talking about the money, and is this right for me? And then he's got this other job as a commentator. He even says, I don't look at it as something to fall back on, but the bottom line is he's got something to fall back on. Zab Judah is still fighting for pride. He still wants to be the king of Brooklyn. That's what they're calling this. And he talked about it, like, that's what I want to be. You know, he's not just trying to, like, sell us on the fight. I think Zab thinks he has a lot of fight in him. I think he would like to be a guy that would get in the position to fight Floyd Mayweather again at 47. So remember, he moved to 40 and he was going to campaign there. Now here he is at 47. That's a rematch I would see. If Zab was able to stop Paulie or really dominate him, honestly, I wouldn't mind seeing him before Amir Khan take on Floyd Mayweather next May. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting
Zab
fight.
Zab has always had problems with prosperity. When his back is against the wall, like it was, let's say, the rematch against Corey Spinks, where he went into St. Louis and knocked out Spinks, this is kind of a similar situation, because as it relates to Zab, he doesn't have the announcing gig. I don't know if he has ancillary income coming in like the way Paulie does. So we'll see what happens. Gabe, Sean Porter, he's up in your neck of the woods working very hard with that whole Victor Conte snack crew. How much of a shot do you give against Devin Alexander?
I'm picking him to win.
Ooh, bold. Very bold.
Yeah, and I haven't made my pick on Paulie and Judah. I lean towards Judah, but I like how busy Paulie was with Broner and the long straight punches and the jab. I think it's a really interesting fight, that fight. I'll pick probably later in the week. I'll leave it in the ring. But in terms of this fight, look at what troubled Devin Alexander. Was a Bradley type, low center of gravity, kind of shorter, hard to get to his body, guy that knows how to box and can get small, get underneath, and kill you to the body. I think that's what Porter's going to try to do all night long. I like him to pound out a decision. I don't know if he can get one, but I like him in this fight. I like his confidence. I like the way he was fighting. I like that he knocked down James Kirkland and how he did it. I just think everything's kind of firing his way, and I know that may be kind of being homerism, having watched him and haven't watched Devin, but I've never been that sold on Devin, and I think he can be gotten to. I think Sean does in this fight.
I think the key for Porter is to close the gap, make it a chest-to-chest fight. I think if it's a chess match, I think Devin wins round by round systematically, wins a fairly easy decision. But if it becomes a physical fight on the inside, because Porter's a strong little guy, people forget he fought, I believe, at super middleweight, believe it or not, with his size, as an amateur. He was going to be a college running back at some level, so obviously he has some physicality and some strength. And Sean Porter has gotten very good sparring. In addition to James Kirkland, which you were there, he's also sparred with a very skilled guy by the name of Demetrius Andrade. So those things make me believe that I think Sean Porter has a very, very good opportunity here to upset the apple cart. Gabe, Laura Trout, is it one of these fights that looks better on paper than on the actual canvas?
It looks good on paper?
Laura, it looks good on paper, but those fights sometimes don't look so good on the canvas.
You know, actually, I think it looks worse on paper than it might actually end up being.
Really?
I think,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, could I look at it like two counterpunchers or southpaws? They're not going to be used to fighting each other. They're that mirror image. And so sometimes that can turn into something kind of ugly. But I tend to think that both these guys are coming into this fight wanting to prove something. Laura got dropped twice against Angulo, a guy that was supposed to be an easy out. And now he's got to prove that he can hang and get back in the sweepstakes for Floyd, or just in some sort of mix. Schaefer wasn't excited about him. And Austin Trout, he was riding high after Cotto and then loses to Canelo, and you really haven't heard anything about him. And I think as nice of a guy as he appears, he's also very prideful, and I think he's going to fight his way into this. And I think he's more aggressive in this fight than we've seen him, and I kind of like him in this fight. I would tend to think that the straighter punches are more well-educated are from Lara, but he just didn't look that great to me in his last fight. Like, he can't pull the trigger or something. I like this fight. I think it's going to be a little more exciting than we think.
Gabe, I think the question is, who's going to lead, and is anyone going to be willing to take that initiative? I mean, both guys, theoretically, characteristically, are counterpunchers. And usually when you put two southpaws, who are two counterpunchers by nature, there'll be a lot of staring, a lot of fainting, not a lot of punching. I actually favor Laura in this fight. But Laura, I got to tell you, I thought was falling apart physically before he busted the eye of Alfred Angulo. So, and I will give Laura credit for this. When the pressure's been put on him, whether it's Carlos Molina or Angulo, he's pretty willing to actually stand and fight and make some entertaining fare. So I don't know what's going to happen here. I think I get the sense it has to be Trout that is going to have to come out of his shell and initiate the action, because a Cuban is going to be a Cuban inside that ring. They are so well-schooled, and they are so stuck in their temperament, you can't really expect them to change realistically. So I'm going to go with Laura. As for Bika Durrell, I think it's going to be a typical, ugly, mauling Sakio Bika fight. Now, whether who wins, I don't know. I am leaning towards Sakio Bika based on seasoning and toughness.
Yeah, I mean, I want to like Anthony Durrell. He just doesn't let me a lot of the time. There's something kind of missing from the game, fluidity or something. It's missing from his game. But Bika, I think, is this more professional guy. He's probably going to break him down unless Durrell just really puts together a workload and just kind of attacks him and wears him down and doesn't, you know, stays away from the inside in terms of clinches and letting it become a physically ugly fight. But I've rarely seen a Sakio Bika fight not turn into that. So I lean towards him to hold on to his belt.
347-215-7598. We got about 15 more minutes to go before Monday Night Football. Gabe, who's next on the queue?
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good. What's going on?
Oh, hey, man. I just listened to the show. Love the show, guys. You guys always provide a lot of excellent analysis, man. This is Joseph Heron from the Pugilist Corner on East Side, man. I just want to drop in and tell you guys what an awesome job you guys do every week.
Joseph, thank you very much.
And I also want to get your take on this, brother. Paulie, you know, he was on my show a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about just ranting. And he did this at the press conference as well, you know, in build-up to this fight when it was announced, ranting about the media. Now, basically every – well, yeah, and you guys are used to that. But I wanted to get your thoughts on this because he's seemingly in a very tough predicament every single time he enters the ring, because if you're a judge and you're putting the emphasis on clean, effective punching, no matter how much he actually throws, you know, you're always going to get the judges that favor the guy who throws the heavier bombs in the fight. But he's going to blame it on someone else, like the judges or the media, for not actually calling out, saying that there's a robbery when it's a very subjective process. How do you feel about that, man?
Joseph, I actually am writing a two-piece, a two-parter on Paulie Malignaggi. I mean, he let his hands go like he's never had in the ring with me. And a lot of what he says I agree with. And when he talks about the media, he's talking about guys who are the fanboys, who are basically groupies behind a laptop. And you know who they are, Joseph.
But of course, man.
He said something that was interesting to me. He said that if you had the Broner fight with me at 9-3 or anything worse than 8-4, you're just a groupie and a fanboy. You don't know what you're looking at. But, Joseph, I'll be honest, and I know Paulie very well. I thought it was about an 8-4 fight. And, Joseph, that goes to your point. This is professional boxing, and you're right. If me and you are fighting each other and you have much heavier hands, doing much more damage, and we each land approximately the same amount of punches, guess what, Joseph? You're probably going to win that round justifiably. That's because it's not amateur boxing.
It's clean.
Absolutely. And, you know, Steve, with that said, man, I see him actually following the same exact fight plan he did against Adrian Broner. He actually did a great job of really – because, I mean, you look at Broner, you look at Judah. I mean, whenever those guys come forward, you know, or actually – I mean, those guys like to load up on their shots. They like to – and so they have to plant their feet. You know, one of the things that Paulie actually does extremely well is he will let his hands go and then he'll step to the side and make you follow him, make you use the entire ring. He's very, very good at moving away from your power hand. You know, do you actually see him actually following the same exact game plan he did against Adrian Broner?
Gabe?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of tend to think that he will do that. And Paulie gets upset because it's, you know, it's clean, effective punching. And he's like, look, I'm clearly punching. You know, you can see my punches are being thrown and landed. But he does get kind of docked for having no power in it. On some level, that's not fair because he doesn't fight like an amateur boxer. He does actually kind of step into his shots. And he landed pretty good on Broner. I still didn't think he won. But he could make his case. I wonder if he's going to be able to do that with Zab, because Zab's also, you know, he's a power puncher, he's a southpaw puncher. I think Zab actually knows how to, he's an old fighter, but he's not, you know, I don't think he's shot. I think he's an experienced fighter at his age, and he always talks about getting better, and I think in recent years we've seen him kind of change a little bit. There was that Purnell period where he was starting to mind his defense, and then he kind of went back to being himself. I don't really know who he was in the first half of the Garcia fight. And I think there can be a lot learned there from Paulie by what
Joseph.
Danny was doing.
But yes, sir.
Well,
Gabe, Joseph, I think this fight's going to be tough to score, and I'll tell you why. As Gabe pointed out, Paulie is pretty steady with his punching. There's a steady drum beat. It's like being hit with raindrops over and over again. Zab nowadays, because he's older, likes to work in spurts. So I can envision a lot of rounds where Paulie is steady, and he's got these little BBs shooting at you. And once in a while, Zab is going to throw that big bullet. So then, as a professional judge, you have to make that decision. Do I like those two or three big telling blows of Zab Judah, or do I like the steadiness and the consistency of Paulie Malignaggi? See, that's going to be a very difficult job for those judges.
That's why I said, you know, that's why I brought up the Broner fight. I see this being the exact same situation as, you know, where Paulie, I think, is going to lose a very close, controversial decision in which it's the very subjective process. Do you like quantity or do you like quality?
Well, hold on, but Joseph, remember this now. And he's complained about this, and this is ironic. He now has Al Haymon. So he may already be up 2 points on the scorecard before the first bout. Let's be very honest about the politics here.
That's kind of the problem I've got with his rant about the media or about the business, because he's kind of one of those guys, when it goes his way, he doesn't say anything. He doesn't talk about Pablo Cano. There's no interest in a rematch. And he didn't.
Hey, come, hey, Dave, haven't you heard that old saying? If you can't beat him, join him.
Joseph, listen,
we appreciate you calling in. We got to let you go. Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, the last thing I wanted to chime in on, I wanted to get your perspective on this as well. James Kirkland, obviously he's back with Ann Wolfe, but he's been back with her, training with her for 6 weeks. Is that enough time for a very hungry young fighter like Glenn Tapia? But anyway,
Dave,
guys, thank you so much. The floor is yours. Thank you, Lester. Thank you guys for letting me chime in. And you guys always do a great job, man. Enjoy listening to you.
Please join us again. Gabe, go ahead.
I think it was actually like 5 weeks all told. But, I think if he had come in, you know, the way he was for the Molina camp, just fat and uninterested, I would say he's got problems. There's not enough time. But he was definitely on weight when I saw him. I mean, I think Ann tended to think he was more 165. I'd heard he was 68, but, you know, who knows. But still, he was very much on weight 5 weeks out. And so all she was doing was fine-tuning him. And she said it took a few days, but like 3 days. But the first time in the Molina camp, it took 3 weeks to see if James was still there, you know, if the guy that she was reclaiming was going to exist anymore. She thought maybe he was shot. And then 3 weeks in, all of a sudden, he started to appear. She said it took 3 days this time
Gabe,
around. So I think he's
Gabe, wait, when a trainer says, I think James Kirkland is shot, that may literally mean a million things, okay? But with that being said, as Henry Ramirez says, as it related to his dear old heavyweight, Chris Areola, if you do a training camp, that's fine. But if you do a fat camp, that's
right.
A whole different story. And if he's in shape, 5 or 6 weeks is plenty of time. Gabe, anyone else on deck here on the phone lines?
Let's see. The 954, no, actually, let's see. I'm trying to find the longest one. 714, we might have actually cleared the boards. I think some people hung up. Now let's try this one. In the 215, you are live on the next round. 215?
Yes, hello?
Yes. Is this the city of Philadelphia?
Yeah, this is Fair Sheikh.
Oh, what's going on?
Hey, what's up?
Guys always catch me while I'm running, but it's okay. I'm going to do it this time. I want to talk about, I pick Rios to win that fight. I want to speak on that a little bit first. I just feel like
sure.
I just feel like the Rios that showed up was not the Rios I expected. I mean, he didn't seem relentless like he usually be. And Pacquiao boxed beautifully. So I just want to get that out of the way to say I was totally wrong. Another thing, I want to speak on Adonis Stevenson. Me personally, since my first time ever seeing Adonis Stevenson fight, I'll make a bold statement. I think he's trash, man. I don't think he's a good fighter at all.
Hold on. You don't even think he's improved trash? He's just still trash?
He's trash to me. I think his right hand is like a baby's arm. It's just like I no power in it at all. And only thing he do different now is move his feet more. Before he used to stand still a little longer. I think now he just prolongs himself from being knocked out again by moving so much. I think once he gets a guy that's really going to understand that his right hand is a baby's arm and it's going to really move to the side, stay away from that left hand, I think he's going to get knocked out again.
You know, I'll say this.
I agree with you.
The ability to move your feet, though, and change distances and go in and out of danger, I wouldn't discount that, though. Listen, am I saying that this guy is a left-handed Bob Foster or Archie Moore? No. But I think he's a little bit more well-rounded than people are giving him credit for. And this recent run, it's not the greatest, but Tony Bellew is usually very durable. Divorce Cloud had never been stopped. And he basically ruined Chad Dawson after what Andre Ward did to him. It's not a bad run, guys. I don't think a guy who's quote-unquote trash, it looks that impressive through those three fights, in all fairness.
I mean, personally, I think that Chad Dawson was ruined way before Andre Ward. Tab Dawson just looked like crap in his last few fights. After John Pascal, Chad Dawson can never look good ever again. So
I would agree with that.
I don't disagree.
He looked okay against Hopkins, I thought, and then they fell.
Hopkins fight was garbage.
Yeah, both of them. We saw them.
Oh.
So let me ask you this, then, before we let you go. If Kovalev fought Stevenson, what's your official prediction?
I look for a Darnell Boone one.
Well, no brotherly love there, Chief. All right, listen, we're running out of time. We got to let you go, okay?
All right, take it easy, y'all.
All right. Gabe, if there's one more call, we could probably sneak in one more call here. What's going on? You got anyone else on the queue?
I'd be pulling people. But it always seems like Fair Shake is calling us from doing road work.
Hard work, dedication. And speaking of which, Gabe, this show box on Friday, we have to get to this in the last waning moments of the next round. From Little Creek Casino in Washington, the ghost of Gary Shaw here on Showtime is very alive and well. We have a triple header featuring Jay Leone Love, Mickey Bay Jr., and Badou Jack. I guess you would call this collateral damage in terms of working with Floyd Mayweather if you're Showtime.
This is kind of – I mean, you know, Mickey Bay is an action guy. Jay Leone Love, action fighter. So, you know, Badou Jack is always action, but this is kind of Thanksgiving leftovers. But it's developmental stuff. I mean, I don't know. It is the TMT show. It isn't going to be all that great, but, I mean, I don't know. This is Showtime taking over HBO.
Well, Gabe, first of all, I disagree about that being Thanksgiving leftovers. I actually look forward to Thanksgiving leftovers. Okay, this is more like fruitcake. Okay, if you want to go in the holiday spirit. I don't know. I don't know much about the fights, to be honest with you. I haven't really researched them. This is something I'm going to DVR because, quite frankly, I got better things to do on a Friday night. But we'll see here. I think Jay Leone Love has to show something. I saw early on in his career when he was with TKO Promotions. He's leveled off. I thought he was very, very fortunate to get a draw against Gabriel Rosado. I want to see what he has left. I think that the death of his brother, Reggie, really affected him because I know for a fact how close they really were. All right, well, listen, that's it for this week's show. I'd like to thank everyone that made this show possible. Leave It in the Ring Radio Network, led by David Duenas. I'd like to thank all the callers who took time out of their busy day before Monday Night Football to join us. So on behalf of Gable Montoya, this is Steve Kim saying till the next round, goodbye, everybody.